Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today, I'm super excited to have with me Annalisa Dragic. Annalisa is a partner at Sapphire Ventures. And in today's episode, we talk about go-to-market fit for Series B, how founders should be thinking about exits over the coming months, why it's important to have a balanced level of EQ on your board, and what it meant to be the youngest female partner in Europe. You're going to love this episode. Don't miss it. Hello and welcome to this episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today in the studio with me, I am super excited to have Annalisa Dragic. Annalisa is a partner at Sapphire Ventures, an enterprise VC firm investing in visionary teams to build companies of consequence, where she invests at Series B to IPO. Listen to our primer episode if you want a bit of a lowdown on Annalisa's journey. Right now, though, I'm super excited to just get straight into it. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Amazing. Well, let's dive straight in. One of the things that I'm really interested in is to understand whether there is truly a squeeze happening right now at later stages. Mm. What are you seeing in terms of kind of valuation compression?
Yeah, so as mentioned, you know, Sapphire, we're investing at kind of Series B all the way to IPO. And so that is the growth stage. And I do think, though, that kind of where we see the market right now, it's a little bit different in that kind of pre-IPO camp. And then you kind of have, kind of Series C, Series D, and then you have Series B. That's kind of how I would break it down. Mm-hmm. Obviously, over the last year, 18 months, like in public markets, we have seen pretty dramatic shifts there when it comes to tech valuations and also the IPO window closing. And so I think in that kind of pre-IPO bucket, you have a lot of companies that are, you know, just kind of in the holding pen. And I think the question there really is like, well, what is it going to take to IPO?
Yeah. And actually, where are those exit opportunities? IPO, the SPAC craze has obviously died like completely. Trade sales are obviously going to be trading at much lower valuations, presumably. Yeah. So how do these guys actually now exit?
Yeah. So I think as a little bit of wait and see, I think a lot of founders, they still have that ambition and still have the goal to be there and ringing the bell and being a public company. But I think that's likely going to mean that you need to be a bigger company, as in terms of like revenue size and from a profitability, probably more profitable than what we have seen, of the IPOs that happened in like 2021, say. So I think it's a little bit TBD, as we'll see kind of maybe who's the first company to go out and if that's, you know, a direct listing or more so IPO. So kind of TBD there. I do think that you will see more of the tech private equity players becoming more active. I think you already see them.
Yeah, because they've got a lot of capital sitting there, dry powder.
They have a lot of capital, a lot of dry powder, and you already see them being active in the public markets, mm-hmm. being like taking companies private. And so I do think that, you know, companies that are in that pre-IPO kind of holding pen right now, some of those may exit to PE buyers as mm-hmm. well. And of course, I think also still from a strategic perspective, like M&A, I don't think that's going to go away. I think right now, large corporates and just the number of companies that can make an acquisition at a billion plus is not that many. And they're just still trying to figure out their own kind of strategy.
Well, they're all
and some
cost
issues.
Cutting as well, right, at the moment.
So. Yeah. So yeah. There's, I think we're going to have to kind of wait and see a little bit in that bucket. I think in the kind of Series C, D, E, that kind of like, what I would say, kind of like core growth stage, a lot of companies there raised a lot of money in the last like 2 years, maybe one round, maybe two rounds, right? So I think there, what we see is that companies are just not really raising right now, which I think is honestly the smart decision from the founders, because they don't need to. They're sitting on 100 million plus of cash. A lot of companies there are trying to, you know, have those discussions with their board around balancing growth and efficiency. But these are companies that have a really solid business. And so they're not going anywhere. But I think we haven't seen as many data points around raises there to really kind of know from a valuation perspective, like where things are at the current moment, yeah. kind of shaking out. Of course, those founders are seeing what's happening in the public markets, and they're still, and they are very much, you know, with the eyes of being a public company. And so try, of course, that has kind of impacts in their understanding, like where they're sitting. Then I think what's the really, for me, in my opinion, most interesting part of the market at growth stage is probably that early growth mm-hmm. area, which is more around like Series B, mm-hmm. which we're seeing the most activity in the market right now. And I think that really comes down to companies who raised a Series A, are still growing, have amazing products, are doing something that customers really love and want to buy, and they need to scale up. So they need more capital. And then I think the question really for founders becomes, okay, you know, if I know that I want to take on more capital, but in what way do I do that? Do I do an extension round of my A? Do I mm-hmm. do a convertible? Do I go out for a Series B? And like, what are the data points that I need to show in those different scenarios to get also from a valuation perspective, you know, around that's also going to work for them and their investors?
Yeah, I mean, we're going to talk about that in a second, but a couple of questions on that. I think that's super interesting. And the whole kind of wait and see, I think we've got another 6 months of this because mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of stuff that's going to shake out over the next 6 months. You know, companies that have raised at large valuations, large amounts of capital, but haven't necessarily printed the sort of numbers they need to be printing, haven't yeah. had to raise over the last year, maybe going to have to come out, to your point, either do extensions or potentially down rounds or flat rounds, etc. But one of the things I was just sort of thinking whilst you were talking was how much of this has impacted their ability also to now take secondaries. So like, you know, where typically at A, but more predominantly at B and beyond, founders will take some of their risk off the table, take some of their cash off the table. Is that still happening or has that become harder now for founders to do?
I think it's most common for a secondary to happen with a primary mm-hmm. capital mm-hmm. raise. That's you kind of yeah. most usually see those together. So because we're not seeing the primary,
yeah.
seeing less secondary. That said, I do think you are seeing secondary opportunities from a growth stage investor perspective in the market, because early stage investors, you know, are maybe they're trying to go out and raise another fund, or they need to show kind of DPI to mm-hmm. their LPs. Mm-hmm. And so we have seen probably in the first few months of this year kind of an increase in secondary opportunities, but coming from early investors in the company versus like a CEO or yeah. employee tender or things like this.
Yeah. So, okay. So just for our listeners, so, you know, DPI, you know, is effectively a measure of how much cash is returned to the fund. And presumably, yeah, to your point, this is because they need to show growth. They need to be able to go out, raise a second fund, which also is, you know, we can talk about what LPs are doing, but maybe that's a whole separate podcast potentially. But yeah, I mean, like even talking to family offices, I can see that, you know, they are holding back. You know, obviously there are more or less risky ways of getting returns now in a higher interest environment. So that makes life a lot more difficult. So I can completely see why that might be driving that. But let's talk about then, you know, you talked about growth and efficiency, right? And going from Series A to Series B has been relatively fluid over the last 5 years. I think obviously yeah. we all know that like the yeah. nomenclature of rounds has changed, and you know what used to be a Series A is probably, you know, a seed round now or whatever it might be. So what do ventures actually need to be printing in terms of numbers versus say 3 years ago when yeah. when they get to be like what are their metrics and what do their numbers need to look like for you guys to consider them a true B round?
Yeah. I think this is like a question that's on the mind of a lot of CEOs right now. You know, when I think back to like 3 years ago, that was also when I was transitioning from working at Atomico, which was very much focused on Series A, to then working with Sapphire and launching the London office, and that's Series B and later. So even myself, like as an investor, I have kind of shifted and gone a little bit later. And kind of at the same time as a lot of CEOs who I was talking to at Series A, they're also making this shift. And I think like when you think back to maybe, you know, 3 years ago, definitely, or even 2 years ago, right? What was a Series B was very loosey-goosey, and there was a huge spectrum. I think now things have kind of settled out a little bit more, and I think that's true kind of Series A and later. I think, you know, when I talk to founders, I kind of try to describe it as like, you know, when you first have an idea and then you have a technology and you have to make then that technology into a product and something that you can sell and get into the hands of customers. And then the next milestone is product market fit. And that's actually understanding, okay, is this a product that my customers actually really want and love and find ROI from? And I think product market fit, that's really a key milestone for Series A.
Yeah.
And that's what a lot of investors look for. Then I think after product market fit comes go-to-market fit. Mm. And that's a lot of what at Series B, investors like Sapphire, that's what we're looking for. So we don't like to take product risk. We want there to be very clear product market fit. And I think that comes both qualitatively from talking to customers and understanding from them what's the ROI that they're seeing, but also from the dollars that they're spending, right? And that then shows up in metrics such as churn or net dollar retention. Like, are you actually being able to expand these customers over time? But I think really the crux of the go-to-market fit is understanding how your sales and marketing engine is working. Mm-hmm. How are you selling this product to market? Are you doing this from a sales perspective? Is this inside sales? Mm-hmm. Is this, you know, field sales out there selling to large enterprises? Are leads coming in inbound, outbound? Are you doing something through PLG? Are you targeting developers and having a really robust community
for them? So basically,
have
you got a playbook that you can replicate?
Is there a strategy? Yeah, yeah. Is there a strategy for go-to-market? That's the first step. And then proving to an investor that you have go-to-market fit is really about that repeatability and momentum, which takes some time. That's not something that overnight, you know, okay, now I know my strategy and next week I already have this and it's repeatable and I can show this. That's usually, you know, at least 2, maybe 3 quarters of data points that you can prove. Because for a Series B investor, a lot of the capital that we invest, of course, it's going to continue to go into R&D and continuing to flesh out the product. But a big chunk of that capital is going to go into growth and it's going to go into sales and marketing. And we want to understand, is there a clear, you know, understanding from the team of how that capital is going to be used and the ROI on that investment?
Yeah. And it's not enough to just say we're going to spend it on marketing, presumably at Series B. I mean, the question that comes to mind, I mean, like, because go to market fit is a series of playbooks, as we said, right? So that might be a market playbook, it might be a geography playbook, it might be a customer playbook, whatever it might be. But equally, what about the sort of the metrics that they need to be showing? Are there still, because, you know, it used to be sort of growth at all costs. And you know, we were talking about earlier the fact that obviously a lot of software businesses, certainly in the public markets, have proven to be a little less than efficient. So do they now, do companies at Series B now need to be showing both growth as well as positive unit economics? Do they need to be able to show that pathway to a profitable business? And how do you think about that in the current market?
Yeah, so I think I can speak to B2B and B2B software companies because that's what I'm looking at on a day-to-day basis. Obviously, kind of the P&L of an enterprise software versus the P&L of a B2C
consumer app, yeah,
is going to look different. Yeah. So talking about in the B2B world, I think, well, maybe two comments. One, I think growth stage investors have always been very focused on the unit economics of a business because that's the solid foundation for that growth and go-to-market scaling. That's what helps take you from being, you know, 10 million in ARR to being 100 million plus. So from the Sapphire perspective, like in terms of the metrics that we look at, the discussions that we have in our investment committee, like nothing has changed since when I joined and now. I think in the general VC ecosystem, though, and I have felt this, you know, on boards that I'm on or just talking to founders inside, outside of our portfolio, there seems to be a bit of like a whiplash, especially I think from some of the earlier stage investors who were just very much like growth, 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 and know now you need to have like a path to profitability. which I think is a little bit misleading because for a young company, you do want to be focused on growth. Like
yeah.
you have a new product, something that you want to get that out into market. You want to get those data points for customers, not only to grow as a company, but also to get the feedback, right? Mm-hmm. To be able to improve what you are doing. And a lot of times also you need more people in the company to be able to deliver that. So I don't think it's the right answer in this environment to have these companies that are approaching Series B completely swing and be mm-hmm. like, okay, coming to me and being like, this is now my clear path to profitability and I'm going to be cash flow positive, because it's also very hard for a company to
grow profitability. Yeah.
But also kind of emerge from that profile. If yeah. you're going and your goal is to be, profitable and cash flow positive, and then to kind of go into hypergrowth again, that's very difficult for a company to do. So I think the best thing, and what I'm trying to advise founders, especially in between kind of the Series A, Series B phase, is like, you still need to experiment. You still need to figure out kind of what works, but you need to have an ability to make data-driven decisions and to be able to pivot quickly to say like, this is working, this is not, this is where I'm going to invest more, this is where I'm going to stop investing.
Mm.
And I think what we've seen previously is a lot of companies, they just weren't collecting all the metrics that they needed to make those data-driven decisions, and were probably in that experimentation phase for too long.
Mm.
And I think part of that was because there was a lot of capital flowing into the ecosystem and they didn't necessarily feel like those constraints or like scrappiness that they needed. But I think the founders who have that mindset of, no, I only really want to invest into areas that are working, those are going to be the companies that are going to be the long-term successes.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I guess, especially within venture where you're looking for outsized returns, you can't stymie growth. You need to no. still have that, right? Otherwise, you can't have those outsized outcomes. And I think, like, fully agree from a finance perspective, once you get to cash flow positive or profitability, if you are then just reinvesting off your own balance sheet, it's impossible to create the same growth curve, the same J curve, and therefore you needed outside capital. And if you've got outside capital, then you're obviously going to drop back into sort of negative EBITDA, certainly, because you are going to be focusing on growth, and that will require both more people as well as more experimentation. But hopefully, as you say, experimentation with data to prove that those bets are going to pay off. That's super interesting.
Yeah. One other comment just to add to that, I think it's also a mindset, like a culture change of the company too, right? Which I think is quite hard. Like, you as a CEO need to be the one who's kind of steering the ship, but you can't take like a hard right and then a hard left. Like that is like very jarring to culture of the company.
Mm.
So I think also from that perspective, it's hard to slow down so much that you then, okay, feel like you're in, very much control, and then to reaccelerate again. Very, very hard to do.
Yeah, I've gone from being funded to now bootstrapping and much earlier stage, certainly not Series B. And I can see that even mentally right now, my mindset is, I don't think I'm going to raise more capital, because I can't see how I could bootstrap and then reignite necessarily in the same way. I mean, maybe I could. Because also it's that much earlier, but I having worked with businesses that have actually, raised quite a fair amount of capital and then decided not to raise additional and slowed down sort of the growth, they've stayed very stable. And the question then becomes, are they venture backable again? Right? Because that's the other signal is, okay, well, you slowed down, you've now, your growth has maybe shrunk from whatever 100%. 3x year on year to like 1x year on year, or maybe even less. You're also not able to then show that same growth curve that would presumably have an investor like you look at it and say, yeah, this is exciting. This is going to take it to the moon. No, that's super, super interesting. And I think for all the founders out there that are trying to figure out, how do I get from Series A to Series B? Clearly, this is something that you need to listen to and understand. And I guess, the main takeaway, for me is it's all about that go-to-market strategy, post-product market fit. How do you now create that replicable growth engine that you can go out and make sure that you're hitting the numbers? Go on.
I would just say, and also, I think it's a good idea to talk to, like growth stage investors earlier on, right? Because I do think, you know, when you get to Series A, after that, the group of investors changes, right? Yeah. It's a different set of names that are kind of playing in the larger check size. And so, like, if I think about the companies that we've backed in Sapphire Portfolio, like, we've known all of them for at least a year, at least 18 months before we invested. And so having kind of some periodic, you know, checkpoints, and then also you can have a pretty open, honest discussion around, hey, this is where I'm at, this is where I think kind of benchmark, you know, the milestones I want to hit before I raise that next round. I think a lot of founders, they don't know, but they don't also don't ask. So like that, those are the type of questions that I very much welcome from founders, because I'm happy to have those conversations.
Well, it also, I mean, it serves your purpose as an investor, because you want to be in front of you want those businesses in front of you so that you can keep an eye on what might look like a breakout for the future. I would recommend listening to this podcast, obviously, if you want to hear more from investors about what they're looking for, but equally, like, launch your own podcast, right? If you're not sure how to have a conversation with a VC, I found it very, very, very fulfilling to do it that way. But I mean, I think, I think founders should be talking both to customers and to investors, like, especially if they are looking for VC funding, because you need to know what milestones you're going to need to hit, right? Because it's pointless going off in one direction if those aren't going to be the numbers or the sort of dynamics that your next investor wants to see. And again, as you say, you're graduating from those seed Series A investors to, I would argue, also, you know, a smaller number of larger kind of, you know, Series B check and beyond. And obviously then, you know, there's a sort of conversion between sort of VC and PE at that sort of level as well. So, you know, figuring out who is the right fit and who is going to take you forward, I think, and who's going to partner with you to that journey to IPO, as we talked about, you know, is super important. But just changing tack a little bit, right? So I want to talk about your time at LinkedIn, which my one complaint is, like, what is up with that algorithm? What did you do to it? Please, can you explain how to make it work? But, you know, what drove the leap from, you know, a large tech corporate like LinkedIn, and okay, this was pre and just at the acquisition by Microsoft, into venture? Because, you know, I see a lot of, you know, a lot of VCs, certainly here in UK and Europe, tend to be sort of finance managers, if I can put it that way, or have come from finance directly, whereas you've taken, you know, that operator path to an extent. So it'd be great to understand what, you know, was it something that you wanted to do? Was venture always something that was kind of in your blood, or did it look like just a great opportunity having been at LinkedIn and then kind of moved on, done your MBA and so on?
Yes. So I think I mentioned that I had spent some time in New York with Morgan Stanley and their tech investment banking group. And I think it was there I saw a lot of analysts kind of graduating, finishing, you know, their 1-2 years and then going into the venture world. You know, some into tech PE, some a little bit into hedge fund, but vast majority going and working for Silicon Valley venture firms. And that was kind of something I always had in the back of my mind that I thought would be, you know, a really fun and fulfilling job. I think I made the decision to go and work for LinkedIn because I felt like that would be a great complement to the skill set and the work that I had already done, more so in the investment banking world, to actually get a sense of, like, what was it like to work inside, you know, this company, you know, tech company that's going under hyper growth. And LinkedIn, as you mentioned, has the consumer internet elements that you and I see, but also has a really robust enterprise SaaS part of the building with, like, Recruiter and Sales Navigator and other products now as well. So I thought, wow, this would be awesome. You get to see kind of both the consumer internet parts and enterprise SaaS. So I went into it and I loved my time there as really just an opportunity to learn and to understand.
And on paper, you were strategy and analytics analyst, according to your own LinkedIn profile. Yeah. But it sounds like you weren't actually a strategy and analytics analyst.
Yeah, I was. When I joined, there was 8 of us that they hired, you know, right out of university. And it was the first time that they hired people out of university not to do engineering, not to code, and not to do sales. And so when we were hired, it was still very ambiguous of kind of what exactly our title was, what exactly we were going to do. which, yes, on one hand, it's, you know, has uncertainty, but the on the other hand was super fun because I was like going to be able to go and work in a lot of different groups and also work all over the world with LinkedIn as well. So then, because I was kind of the first class, then it kind of got more formalized and is now called the SOAR program at LinkedIn. And I know this because I went back and talked to the current set of analysts there, which I think is now we're in like the ninth year or something, which I think the eight of us we're like, great, we didn't screw it up.
You
like
paved the way for the future.
And there has been a number of individuals from that program who have gone on to be in VC as well, which I think is awesome. And a lot of people have stayed, you know, people have stayed at LinkedIn, people have, you know, stayed in the tech ecosystem, others have become founders themselves. So yeah, really thankful definitely for those opportunities. And I think it's a great kind of community and program that LinkedIn has built.
And presumably also kind of that whole B2B enterprise part of LinkedIn, if you like, drive some of your investment kind of thesis and decision making and understanding of the businesses that you're working with today, right?
Of course. And I think, you know, I had opportunity during my time at LinkedIn to work on the sales operations team, which I know is called like RevOps these days, which was not necessary. I didn't even know what sales ops or RevOps. I was like, wait, I'm going to sales? Like, do you know me? Like, I should not be doing sales. But actually then being able to partner with the recruiter business in North America, a huge part of the business for LinkedIn, and be the analyst that's in charge of tracking all of these metrics and actually helping the sales leaderships like understand the performance. And again, where we should be investing, where should we be investing less, and how we should change things. I think that was very beneficial to now what I'm doing sitting in the boardroom, but having that experience that was like much more in the weeds and in the details, super helpful.
And I mean, this is a slightly loaded question, but what's your feeling around kind of operator VCs versus non-operator VCs? Like what, is it valuable? Like there's a lot of debate out there. And I saw a Twitter post recently, I can't remember who wrote it necessarily, but you know, they said, you know, there's a lot of talk about, you know, operators make better VCs, but actually they are two different jobs, and how you think as a VC is slightly different to how you would think as an operator. And from my own perspective, as an operator, I find, you know, I get very detail orientated, whereas, you know, VC, you need to be able to abstract away a little bit. You obviously need to understand the detail, but you also need to be able to extrapolate out into the future. So what's your kind of take on how valuable that operator experience is?
I think in my case, I find it super valuable, but I also don't think that there's one right way to be a VC. You know, there's other investors that I sit on boards with who have been in the finance industry their entire career and are super smart individuals and I think bring a lot of value to the companies. So I don't think it's something that you necessarily need to have. I do think as a founder and as a CEO and how you think about crafting your board and who's sitting in that room with you, you do want people who have different experiences because that then brings out, you know, diversity of thought and opinions, which I think helps drive better decision making. And I think we are seeing more and more operators turned angels in the European ecosystem, and also then, you know, even more VCs going out and looking to hire individuals, you know, associates or analyst associates who are not just coming from kind of tech investment banking or consulting, but have done other things as well, which I think is really valuable. Like even when I think about when I made like the first hire for Sapphire and we hired our first associate, you know, her background, she had done some seed stage investing. She'd also worked in PE, but she had also tried to build her own company as well, which I think just gives a lot of empathy in terms of how you discuss with founders. So I think like the number one thing, be that like, you know, financial knowledge and training and domain expertise or having kind of operating, I think above all of those is your EQ and empathy and how can you actually like really work closely with a founder and be that person who can help kind of influence and guide them, but do that in a way that's really rooted in trust. I think that's the number one most important thing.
Yeah, I mean, I'd 100% agree. You know, not that I've had VCs on my cap table, but the best investors, I mean, all of my investors are amazing, to be honest, but the really active ones are the ones that have supported through, like, you know, are we going to be able to raise again? Are we not going to be able to raise? If we don't raise, what happens, et cetera? And I think, you know, founding a business is a tough journey for anyone, right? And just having that support network, especially in the current kind of environment where things are slightly tougher, it's harder to raise capital. People are obviously shrinking their cost base left, right, and center. Just being able to tap on an investor's shoulder and say, look, I'm feeling slightly vulnerable here. Like, what would you recommend? And just being able to get that different viewpoint. And, you know, you talked about, you know, investors having EQ, but equally founders having that growth mindset where they're able to take on different views and opinions and distill them and make a decision, not necessarily, you know, going with the advice that is given to them, but being able to synthesize the various pieces of advice and taking the best course of action.
Exactly.
Right. And equally, you know, I think at the moment within the ecosystem, you're seeing like, you know, this huge growth of scout programs, venture scouts and venture partners, et cetera, which I think also bring like that additional either skill or knowledge or EQ to the table, which, you know, it's interesting to see, you know, how that's working within the venture ecosystem, because obviously not all firms adopt it. And, you know, a venture partner in one company may have a completely different role and understanding of what that role means in a separate firm. But yeah, I think, you know, the more great talent that you can have around you as a founder, the better it's going to be for your business, and whether they are in the business or whether they're advising, right?
I also want to just add, I think at the growth stage, and as you're in that kind of preparation for IPO, you also think about your board and bringing on independent board members, right? And I think that's a great opportunity also for CEOs to maybe identify some gaps that they have in terms of those opinions or experiences and bring someone on. You know, a lot of times those are ex-operators, but people who have, you know, built, scaled, exited other tech companies, you know, former CFO who can then be, you know, an audit chair for you. And I think that's a great opportunity for CEOs that I would like to see, especially in Europe, more CEOs kind of engage with bringing on really world-class independent board members.
Yeah. And I guess, I mean, the difficulty in Europe is, whilst there are obviously a lot of companies and CEOs and founders that have exited in the US, like here in the UK, certainly in Europe, you know, we still have somewhat a paucity of that level of talent of people that have been through, you know, there's a small pool of people. And I think, you know, finding the right people, finding people who have the availability, the time, when you have a substantially smaller ecosystem is a lot harder, I guess, than what it is in the US. But, you know, they are out there, right? So so it's all
about...
That's
also how a US investor can help you. You know, when I think about like Sapphire, a lot of the work that our talent team does is around independent board members. We're like a founding sponsor of Black women on boards and bringing together those communities. And I think it's a lot about, you know, you might as a founder not know, but your investors
will
know, right? Yeah. And so it's just tapping into the extended network of people who are already around your table and finding an amazing person who wants to be part of your journey.
And of course, if in doubt, use LinkedIn. Although the messaging service at LinkedIn, please, can you fix that as well? Can you speak to someone to fix that? But look, just moving on for a second. So, you know, a few years ago, Forbes wrote that you were possibly the youngest female partner in Europe at 29 at the time. Was that important to you and why?
I think reading those headlines first made me feel a little bit uncomfortable. I'm not someone who naturally gravitates to being out there and talking about myself. I think it's one part of the VC job that's just frankly less enjoyable for me. I'd rather kind of be sitting and working one-on-one with the founders in my portfolio.
And yet you're on this podcast.
Yeah. But I pushed myself
to
do these things because I do think it matters. And I think back to when I first was interning at Atomico. And, you know, I had role models like Carolina Brocato, who I mentioned, now leading EQT Growth, who really brought me in. Sophia Benz, who was there, who's now a partner at Cherry. You had Reshma at Seedcamp, Sonali and Luciana at that time, both at Excel. You had some role models, but not a lot of senior female role models. And so I think it's a bit of, I see it as kind of responsibility to kind of be out there, to be kind of like shining a light. To show, hey, this is possible. This is something that you can do. And, you know, even this week, I went to a dinner of female investors hosted in London. I sat down to a lady who I'd never met before, and she was just a year into venture. And she was like, oh, yeah, like, I know who you are. And I was like, how do you know who I am? Like, what? But I think then it's like, you know, and I think then getting, you know, comments and even messages on LinkedIn from like younger female, you know, associates of saying, you know, you're such an inspiration, I really look up to you. I think that does make me feel proud, but I think it's something that is like, I want to give back. I want to be able to help more women, you know, be able to excel and kind of move up the career ladder in VC. And so I think one way that I can do that is being out and sharing my story and hopefully, you know, being able to share some wisdom with others as well.
Yeah, I think it is really important. I'm really happy you are on this podcast because I think you've said some incredibly insightful and important things. But actually, you know, this podcast is called Nothing Ventured for a reason, right? It's about backing yourself. It's about taking those first leaps. So what advice would you give to, you know, women or other underrepresented kind of communities that are looking to break into venture? What should they be doing? How can they take that first step? What's your advice to them?
I think maybe two things. One, like, network. And I know that can be hard when you feel like, I don't even know what VC is. I don't know anyone. But the thing is you really only have to get to know one person, and then you can, you know, use their extended network and be like, okay, who else do you think that I should talk to? And then go talk to those three or four people and just use it and expand over time. Because I think that will help you be able to learn a lot about the industry as well. And I think with that, networking, but also trying to seek out some mentorship as well, right? I think, like, I do this. I have coffee chats with either, like, especially women who are trying to get into venture, or, you know, associates who are trying to navigate kind of their careers and, like, next steps. And I think finding people who you can relate to and who have kind of been in your shoes and being able to help you with that, I think a lot of people genuinely want to help and want to give back. And so it's just taking those kind of first steps and putting yourself out there. And maybe that is sending some cold in mail messages on LinkedIn, but, you know, just taking those kind of risks and those chances, do it. And then I think the second thing is, like, just try to read as much as you can. You know, I think my mom is a librarian. I grew up very much with, like, a love of learning and, like, books all over my house. And I think that's one of the things about, like, VC is there's things that you can read and learn about the industry, but also just, like, learn about different technologies and different sectors and what's going on, because I think that will also help you better understand maybe where within VC that you kind of gravitate towards. And also, I think it will just help you have richer conversations with investors who are already in the VC industry. And at the end of the day, what I think, you know, in my experience having hired associates, a lot of time the two things that you're looking for is, like, is this person going to work really hard? And is this person, like, curious and, like, passionate about technology? And if you can show people both sides of that, then I think you have a really good shot.
Yeah, I mean, that's amazing advice. I mean, you know, one of the lessons that I put out there is, you know, hire for attitude over aptitude. Like, you can teach skills, right? But you can't teach culture. Yep. And to your point, like, again, I'm someone that has, you know, that loves reading and, you know, has read around certainly the VC industry, but generally, you know, for a long time. And I think, you know, we undervalue how much information there actually is out there. But equally, and the thing that I found, like, you know, on this podcast, to say the least, is how willing people are to come and share their stories and to give you their thoughts and advice. And you know, I would definitely recommend, you know, as you have, you know, that whole concept of networking, being out there, asking the questions and reaching out. Most VCs I've found, like, very few of them have large egos, right? And all of them are curious, and therefore they're just as curious about learning why you want to have a conversation with them as they are in giving their kind of feedback. Annalisa, it's been absolutely incredible having you on the podcast. Thank you so much for joining me. For our listeners, where's the best place for them to look for you online? Are you on LinkedIn, presumably on Twitter or elsewhere? Where's the best place for them to find you?
I'm very active LinkedIn user, so definitely feel free to reach out to me there. And I'm also on Twitter at adragic6.
Amazing. Annalisa, thank you so much for joining me today in the studio for Nothing Ventured. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.